The headlines this hour: at least one anti-coup protester is killed by security forces during fresh demos in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Iran says it is serious and ready to strike a good agreement in talks over reviving the 2015 deal if it serves its national interest. Bahrain's top Shia cleric and the main opposition group Al-Wafaq condemns the appointment of a naval Israeli officer to be stationed in the country. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Anti-coup protest shows no signs of abating in Sudan, with protesters once again hitting the streets of the capital, Khartoum, to vent their anger at the ruling military junta. Now, medics say one protester was shot dead during the fresh rally on Monday. There are no reports of possible injuries. Earlier, the military detained three politicians in its most recent attempt to dominate power. The Sudanese have been taking to the streets since October coup and the formation of a military-dominated transitional government. At least 80 people have been killed and hundreds wounded in crackdowns and protests over the past 4 months. People are also demanding justice for those who have lost their lives during the rallies. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Iranian president says Tehran is seeking a real removal of anti-Iran sanctions in the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the 2015 deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ebrahim Raisi says the rights of the Iranian nation must be respected. He made the remarks in a meeting with the Irish foreign minister in Tehran. Simon Coveney, for his part, said the Iranian nation's lack of trust is due to Washington's failure to abide by its pledges, thus understandable. He said that Dublin believes that the other parties to the JCPOA should offer necessary guarantees to Iran during the Vienna talks if they are seeking to revive the accord. Coveney is on an official visit to Iran. Early on Monday, he also met with his Iranian counterpart. During a presser with Coveney, Hossein Amir Abdollahian also urged seriousness from other parties in the Vienna talks.
We believe that if the U.S. and the three European countries show seriousness in returning to the full implementation of their commitments under the JCPOA, reaching a good agreement in a short time is achievable.
Amir Abdollahian said Iran is serious in hammering out a good deal within the framework of the JCPOA. He also noted that the American side sends messages of good will, but practically does not take any tangible actions. He said that Tehran is keen on reaching a swift agreement in Vienna, but this should be within the framework of Iran's national interest. Amir Abdollahian also urged Western powers to stop what he called playing with time. Earlier on Monday, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani also said the U.S. must now decide whether it will embrace or refuse to accept the requirements for a reliable and durable agreement based on principles agreed to in the JCPOA. The remarks come as Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA are engaged in diplomatic efforts in Vienna to restore the accord, left in limbo following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Homolensky is a correspondent joining us from Vienna to give us the latest on this, and Sid Mustafa Hoshesh, political analyst, also joins us from Tehran to break this down for us. So, Homa, based on what I'm gathering over here, is it correct to assume that we are waiting for the other side to respond, perhaps, to Iran, generally speaking now? Or are there still back and forths that are going on?
Yes, so that is true. At least this is what we're hearing from sources close to the Iranians, that Iran has come with its own proposals or solutions to the outstanding remaining issues and has been waiting for a proper response to them from the other side, but has not received that yet. And as you mentioned there, they are saying that what they want to see, particularly from the U.S., is action, more action. We had a Chinese official quoted as saying recently that it is incumbent on the U.S. at this stage because it is seen as the party responsible for the current situation, because it withdrew in 2018, to take some practical measures so that Iran can in turn take the reciprocal measures that need to be taken. But we're also getting some reports about the issues that remain and need to be resolved. One of them, as we've said time and again, is the issue of guarantees. How can Iran get assurances that the U.S. will not reimpose sanctions, hinder the implementation of the JCPOA, or withdraw from it? We know, of course, that the JCPOA is a political agreement. It's not a legally binding treaty, and that's where the problems lie. How can this issue be resolved? Iran has given its own initiative. The sides apparently are still working on it. But another issue that's come up is the issue of sequencing. So what measure, how, basically, and when will Iran go back to full compliance, and how will the U.S. go back? That's still up for discussion. And also on the issue of Iran's advanced centrifuges when it comes to Iran's nuclear commitments, some reports are suggesting that one of the issues is that Iran has said it will not agree to dismantling its advanced centrifuges or sending them abroad, but prefers to store them in the country and is not going to back down on that. These are, of course, all reportedly in the reports that I'm telling you about. And, of course, when it comes to the scope of sanctions, it looks like Iran is asking for the removal. This is quite clear, of course. All of the Trump-era sanctions, the maximum pressure sanctions, it looks like the Americans have still not agreed to remove all of the sanctions. They say that they will agree to lift the JCPOA-related sanctions, but there are entities and individuals sanctioned under other labels, and there still seems to be no agreement on that issue. So what we're seeing now is, as far as the sources say, is a lack of decisions or concrete measures being promised or being taken by the Americans. What we are also hearing is that if things move and progress well, an agreement or successful conclusion of these talks is still possible, maybe by early March. We'll have to see if that's going to happen. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, you know, just today said that if the right political decisions are made, we don't need to even wait till the end of February, that we can even have an agreement tomorrow.
Said Mostafa Khoshesh, when you take a look at the way that these talks are, I don't want to say progressing, but that they're actually happening, what feeling do you get when you see the way that the other side is acting towards what Iran has presented? Do you feel like they are trying to buy time in any shape or form, something obviously which Iran we have seen come out and reject and oppose?
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, I'm not surprised at all, because Americans have known to be the ones that are looking for a zero-sum game that was behind the JCPOA, despite the very fact that they were claiming in 2015 that they were looking for a win-win game. It was never a win-win game. As we saw, Obama refused to remove the sanctions in essence, but he removed them just over the paper, but avoided, their removal in practice in order not to give Iran any benefit. That was a breach, a major breach, significant breach of the JCPOA, and also taught Iran to stress on verification if it ever wants to revive the deal again. And also Donald Trump, discarded the deal to teach Iran that Iran needs to receive assurances. And these are the two main issues nowadays in the Vienna talks. And now Americans are repeating the same path. I mean, they're moving on the same path. Right from the beginning of the talks, they had a plan. If they could, they imposed a bad deal to Iran, a deal that would be as shaky as 2015, without verifications, without assurances. And now one of the major issues pertains to the assurances, actually. Despite the very fact that Americans would like very much to focus everyone's attention on one single type of assurance, that's a political assurance, and they discuss that they are not able to, bring the Congress into companionship with the Biden administration, that's the political assurance, actually. Iran has been requesting different types of assurances. There has been a long checklist of assurances to make sure that the Americans would not discard the deal again, like trade and legal assurances, as well as nuclear assurances. What Hamal was talking about, keeping the Iranian high-tech centrifuges intact, in store, under a seal of the IAEA, but intact, so that in order to make sure that if Americans would discard a deal again, Tehran would not sustain any damage and would continue its nuclear progress. That's one of the inherent part of the inherent guarantees that Iran's been looking for. Uh-huh. And they are, you know, pressuring Tehran to give it up because they don't want to give any guarantees. As a matter of fact, they want to keep the path open, like in 2015, to defy complying with their undertakings first. And then, if possible, if sometime they come up with a decision, they discard the deal altogether. Sure. Again. So what they want basically in phase one, their prime goal is a not lasting, I mean, a very shaky deal while Tehran wants a stable, reliable deal with the needed verifications and guarantees. Sure. That would be a win-win game for everyone. Mm-hmm. So Tehran wants a stability and this probable deal, but they do not want that. That's their prime objective.
Thank you very much. That's Said Mustafa Khoshchesh, political analyst there.
Thank you.
And Homolevsky, thank you for all the latest there from Vienna. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Bahrain's top cleric has called on all Muslims to stand against any compromise with the Israeli regime and its expansionism. Sheikh Isa Qassam says the Muslim community has the responsibility of opposing Israel's oppressive policies. He has slammed the deployment of a senior Israeli officer to Bahrain as another sign of Israeli colonialist measures. On Saturday, Manama confirmed the stationing of a high-ranking Israeli officer in Bahrain as part of an international coalition. The move was also criticized by Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq. The group said the ruling Al-Khalifa regime's decision for such an appointment was an attack on Bahrain's sovereignty. Al-Wafaq also questioned the popular legitimacy of the Bahraini regime, saying that Al-Khalifa is on a quest to obtain a, quote, fictitious power from the Zionists. The Bahraini uprising is still ongoing even after 11 years since it began. No matter how hard the regime has tried, whether it was banning major political opposition groups or by the total suppression of human rights, Bahraini people mark the anniversary of the country's uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al-Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wafaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution.
Actions that the regime has taken against them will continue to be opposed because the people want to be able to live in freedom and dignity. The government has not shown any receptivity toward the desires of the people.
Bahrain has come under pressure from human rights organizations over its prison conditions, including overcrowding, poor sanitation, and lack of medical care. This also includes sham trials that were held. There have been many reports of regime torture on the detainees. Manama has gone to great lengths to clamp down on any sign of dissent.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community.
But as we have seen for the past 11 years, they'll continue to fight against these, and we can only hope that other countries will support them.
Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
Saudi warplanes have carried out air raids on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, targeting a communications system near the telecom ministry. Yemeni sources say the strike destroyed the Tele Yemen Telecom Company building and damaged a neighboring building. Riyadh claims the ministry is being used by Yemeni forces to control drones targeting Saudi positions. The coalition had earlier asked civilians in Yemeni ministries in Sana'a to immediately evacuate. Last week, Yemeni forces said that they had hit a military target at the Saudi Abha International Airport with a drone. The Yemeni army, backed by popular forces, has been intensifying its attacks in response to the ongoing Saudi-led war and blockade, which have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Subject, Roots of Differences of Values in the World. Today, thank Allah, we are faced with two groups, both of whom are valuable. A group of teachers of the nation throughout the country, of course a group of them, and also a group from the Red Crescent Society. The value in the world differ based on doctrines and based on opinions. With the study of doctrines, which exist in the world and the religions of the world, we can understand that values differ in religions and also the ideas differ. If you overlook the monotheist and divine doctrines and refer and study the materialist doctrines and the ideas behind materialism, we will notice that these two doctrines are opposite to one another and different from one another.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that in the path of a revolution and for its victory, offering sacrifices and being sacrificed are inevitable, especially a revolution that is staged for God, for religion, and the deliverance of the oppressed. Now, in this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini is basically talking about the sacrifices which are being given. Obviously, we need to pay some cost in order to gain something, but even though when someone gives his life in the path of Allah, which is being said in the Quran, fi sabilillah, in the path of Allah, he sacrifices himself for a greater cause, for the cause of Allah, for the cause of religion, and the true religion, which is the truth, and to overthrow the oppression, and to be with the oppressed ones.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala.
Allahu alayhi salli ala rasul allah ya rabbana salli ala wa an nabiy
when we look at this cause and when we look at these sacrifices, it looks very little. Obviously, this cause is to bring justice, and this justice will remain forever in this world. And if the people will have the same mentality from the beginning of the revolution till the day they are there and the generations, and they pass it to their generations, this everlasting revolution, which is connected to divine, which is connected to God, will bring justice in the whole world. And it becomes the cause of bringing justice. The people, the other nations will take this nation, this revolution, as a role model. And therefore, we can see that we have seen many revolutions, many uprisings in other parts of the world. We can see that. Why? It's because of the Islamic revolution. It's the blessing of Islam. It is because this nation, with its revolution, has gained its pride. It has come out of the umbrella of a system which is known as capitalism, which was a system of oppression, which was the system of injustice. And therefore, when someone raised for God, God gave him a high rank, the rank of being martyr in his path. And this is the win-win situation, that if you live, you enjoy this revolution. And even if you die in this path, you are a martyr. And there is a bigger reward in hereafter waiting for this martyr.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
economic divide.
The U.S.-NATO onslaught on Russia and the premise that Russia will invade Ukraine has brought to the fore political and economic dynamics, including energy, which has sent Europe scrambling, caught in the crosshairs of the U.S. militaristic approach towards Russia. Hi, I'm Omidor Shandell, filling in for Kaveh Tafoyi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how all of these scenarios can play out and whether this will really lead to U.S. isolation. Russia playing the gas card over the standoff on Ukraine. How Europe may cope if Putin shuts off gas. Around 35% of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. Meanwhile, European gas and energy prices are hitting through the roof. Then there's the issue of trade between Russia and Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Will Russia use the energy card to push for continuing trade between Europe and Russia? How will Europe cope or reject the U.S. on this, especially if sanctions were applied on Russia? Then comes the impact of war and sanctions on Russia. World energy prices like oil and gas will be affected, including food, metals, and manufacturing. Even the U.S. will be affected. Import of Russian oil have hit record high, despite souring tide.
Tensions are on the rise between the West and Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine.
I mean, I think we're looking at potentially the most significant conflict that we have seen since World War II. When you look at the kind of composition, the size, the capabilities that Russia is building up on Ukraine's border, it suggests that they're preparing for a relatively significant invasion scenario where they could possibly, you know, encircle Kiev and take half of eastern Ukraine. That's something we haven't seen in decades.
But Moscow has rejected the invasion allegations. The heightened tensions between the two sides has also had a huge economic impact on the involved parties. Ukraine says the panic created over Russia's alleged planned invasion is hurting its economy. Ukraine's economy is already in crisis mode. It needs as much as $5 billion to stabilize. Its currency, the hryvnia, has dropped 8.4% against the dollar. This is one of the worst performers worldwide since November, when Russia again massed troops on the border. The simmering tensions has negatively affected Ukraine's economy. Figures show that tourist arrivals to Ukraine have never recovered since the conflict first started in eastern Ukraine back in 2014. Foreign direct investments have also failed to rejuvenate since 2014. But the crisis is not limited to Ukraine and will stay there. Europe has a lot to lose if an actual war breaks out. European consumers are already paying higher prices for their energy, including gas and electricity.
President Biden, but also even more importantly, European allies, could figure out a new strategy on energy to try to gradually, but more quickly, reduce dependency on Russia, Russian oil and gas. Unfortunately, it's not going to help this year very much, except that if Putin knows that we're thinking about doing that, it creates more credibility that if he moves into Ukraine, that we will retaliate.
In Washington and European capitals, voices are getting louder for a comprehensive sanctions regime against Russia. The U.S. Senate is working on unprecedented sanctions against Moscow. EU countries have also threatened to follow suit.
Of course, it's very important to underline the principles of OSCE, as Ann Linde mentioned. And of course, we are preferring that the EU coordinates this kind of answers well, and EU countries have as unified views and opinions as possible, and this work is ongoing, of course, in Brussels.
Social media posts on the Russia standoff have been wide and far-reaching. This is probably the most extreme case of the world turning bipolar. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, tweeted, "It is Russia that has to make a stark choice. De-escalation and diplomacy, or confrontation and consequences." One viewer had this response posted from the Russian President Vladimir Putin, albeit sarcastically, but maybe to the point. Moving on to the more important life-threatening issue of energy, Europe is stuck in a quagmire. Europe doesn't know what it will do if Russia cuts off its natural gas supply, this tweet says. This viewer poses a serious question for the U.S. If Russia cuts off Europe's energy, the U.S. says it will help Europe with Middle Eastern energy. Okay, but that energy was already bound for China. How do you help Europe without hurting China? You can't. Biden can't think even one move ahead. We have a couple of questions of our own. How can the U.S. guarantee energy to Europe? Where will the U.S. get its oil? Let's not forget, 11% of U.S. oil comes from Russia. Joining us in this segment is Stanley Esrol, an activist at the LaRouche movement. Stanley, welcome. The standoff between Russia and the West, i.e. the U.S. and the EU, has taken on a new dimension. Russia appears to be playing its energy card to assess the situation if and once U.S.-led sanctions are applied. What will Russia do if Europe goes along with the U.S.? Or will Europe probably back down and tries to maintain its ties with Russia, especially on energy?
Well, you have to realize that this is not what appears to be a struggle between the United States on the one hand, Russia on the other hand, and some people might think that Ukraine is important in that struggle. But, you know, recently the Ukrainian president and others in the Ukrainian government have been saying they don't see any particular problem with, or difficulty with anything that Russia is doing. They think that Joe Biden is blowing it up out of all proportions. And the fact is that what we are up against is a global crisis, which is not a human rights crisis. It's not a crisis on, you know, how the individual rights of various people are being protected. It's not a crisis of who controls Ukraine. It's a crisis of, does the global financial network have control anymore? Do they? And this is something that has been building up really since the end of the Second World War.
Now joining us is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, welcome. Here's where things get a little crazy. There's a lesser known fact, and that's the issue of Russian crude exports to the U.S. U.S. reliance on Russian oil hits record high despite souring ties. Now, why then would the U.S. shoot itself in the foot by acting so crazily and aggressively toward Russia, not to mention the rest of the world?
Okay, well, first off, it's impossible to really cut off Russia's energy exports entirely. Europe can cut off the exports to Europe, which will, of course, have an effect on the Russian economy. But there's the whole rest of the world, and there's a big rest of the world. We have to also remember that sort of economic center of the planet shifts more and more towards Southeast Asia every year, which also means they have their own energy needs. So it would have an effect on the Russian economy, a negative effect. It's really been believed that all that the Russian economy has is oil and natural gas, okay, that's it. And if we look back to the sanctions policies going all the way back to 2014, it would seem to prove otherwise. You know, the Soviet Union got sanctioned.
Well, this is our info news section of the program where we review some economic news that we deemed important from around the world. Our first time is a look at inflation. How many times have we warned about this to plague the world, really? Starbucks, the ones that make coffee, announced we are forced to raise prices due to inflation and supply chain issues. At the same time, the company's profits went up 31%, and the CEO got a 39% raise. That sounds like companies are rebranding corporate greed as inflation. Moving on. Did you like the name Meta or Facebook? Well, Facebook has lost market share big time. It saw its biggest stock market loss of over $230 billion, also a record daily loss for a U.S. firm. Its shares fell 26.4% after quarterly figures disappointed investors. It makes you wonder how a name could be a game changer for the bottom line. Moving on, $8.4 trillion. That is how much tax-dodging billionaire dynasties could cost the U.S. The wealth hoarding by ultra-rich families would be equivalent
to over four quote build back better plans, according to this report. This would happen over the next few decades, citing loopholes like estate and gift taxes for the rich as the reasons. Now, our final look is at Canada. It lost 200,000 jobs in January, and the unemployment rate rose to 6.5%. This was because of the lockdowns and the mandates. But a lot of unwarranted blame is leveled against the truckers. Food services and hotels were among the hardest hit, with young people and women most affected.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the in-depth section of the program, and for this section, we want to take a look at the impact of this crisis on Europe, then the world as a whole. First up, a look at the Russia-EU trade balance, in particular, EU exports and imports to and from Russia. EU exports about 89.75 billion euros, and when it comes to EU imports from Russia, that figure stands at 170 billion euros. The question that comes up here is whether Russia will use the energy card or not when it comes to Europe. Let's look at the temptation. First, a look at energy. Russia was the largest exporter of natural gas to the European Union in 2019 and 2020, the figure standing at around 35%. You can call this a good leverage, wouldn't you say? Secondly, there are concerns that Russia could be using this crisis to lobby for the newly completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline to come online by not sending more natural gas for Europe's storage. Nord Stream 2 is a major supplier of gas to Germany. Now comes the role that the U.S. is playing, a dubious one. The U.S. is desperate to increase its market share of natural gas. And what better way than to demonize Russia, then move in to replace Russia as the main supplier to Europe? The former U.S. President Donald Trump made no bones about that, even though he didn't name Russia by name.
Giving new meaning to the expression alternative energy, President Trump today told Europe's leaders that the United States is more than ready to be the continent's alternative energy source, an alternative, that is, to Russia, who the president suggested has used its energy dominance in the region to hold it hostage.
Let me be very clear about one crucial point. The United States will never use energy to coerce your nations, and we cannot allow others to do so. We are sitting on massive energy, and we are now exporters of energy. So whenever you need energy, just give us a call.
We are committed to securing your access to alternate sources of energy, so Poland and its neighbors are never again held hostage to a single supplier of energy.
Now, when Trump talked about alternative sources of energy and how the U.S. can replace Russian gas supplies to Europe, he was talking about fracking or shale gas production, something which the Russian president slammed. Now, let's have both of our guests rejoin us on this. First, to Stanley Israel, activist of the LaRouche movement. Stanley, there's the issue of trade between the EU and Russia. The trade between the two is quite vital. Now, Europe is Russia's biggest trade partner. It actually accounts for 37.3% of the country's total trade in goods with the world in 2020. Obviously, there's not a strong desire for either Europe or Russia to have this trade stopped. Is Europe diverting from the U.S. on Ukraine for its own sake?
Not at all. And we are seeing that there are a number of leading people in Germany, in France, in other places, people who are experts on the economy, who have publicly pointed this out. The United States trade with Russia, you know, whichever way you go, whether it's, you know, U.S. to Russia, Russia to the United States, is 3 to 3.5%. Russian trade with Europe is, as you pointed out, in the range of 40% plus. So the United States, who is pushing this, has really nothing to lose by cutting off trade with Russia. Europe does.
Now, joining me is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, what do you think? The U.S. not to have that much to lose, as our other guests stated. And now, if that is the case, what can Europe do in order not to fall victim economically to U.S. warmongering toward Russia?
Well, again, this is a demonstration that, on the one hand, Europe always seems to be very united against dictators, in quotes, from other countries. But then when push comes to shove, they all want to work with said countries. And this is the perfect example where, despite sanctions that the European countries vote for, all the big businesses go around them. The sanctions really haven't changed that much. There are still plenty of European-owned factories operating in Russia. There's a lot of interchange between the countries, or goofy ways of getting around all these sanctions by selling something to Belarus, and then the Belarusian sell to Russia, or through Switzerland, or whatever. So even from the very beginning, if Europe was really, really deeply believed in this narrative that Russia is somehow this evil aggressor who's going to come and destroy them, their actions would be radically different.
Russia supplies about 30% of Europe's oil and 35% of its natural gas, which would be cut off in the event of conflict and possible sanctions. An actual war would significantly push up energy prices.
Considering that Europe is facing an energy, or better to say, gas crisis right now, making the long-term contracts you mentioned is significant.
Analysts believe oil prices could reach nearly $125 per barrel, with gas prices following higher.
Consequences for the energy markets would be likely would be a further increase in prices of oil and natural gas, and therefore of energy costs more broadly for many countries in the world.
Furthermore, sanctions would surely complicate an already complex situation over Nord Stream 2, which is set to supply Germany with much-needed gas. Sanctions against Russia will badly hurt its economy, but would also be costly for the U.S. and the EU.
Ich würde schon sagen, dass Europa abhängig ist von russischen Gaslieferungen, aber wir importieren ja auch Öl und Steinkohle. Das ist sicherlich richtig. Auf der anderen Seite würde ich aber auch sagen, dass Russland noch sehr viel abhängiger ist von Europa, weil ein Großteil der Einnahmen in Russland durch die Energielieferung fossiler Energien kommen, und sollte das wegfallen, würde Russland sich massiv ins eigene Fleisch schneiden.
Russia is a key producer of agricultural products like barley, corn, sunflower, and rapeseed. Sanctioning Russia will likely increase the prices of these commodities.
In terms of headline inflation numbers, that certainly could keep headline inflation much more elevated for longer. Of course, we are hoping, like all of the international community is, that there can be a peaceful resolution to this issue.
Other key ingredients that the EU countries import from Russia include ammonia, potash, urea, and phosphates. Manufacturing supply chains also would not be immune from either a conflict or sanctions against Russia.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Russian President Vladimir Putin met before the Chinese Olympics kicked off, and they displayed their anti-US stance in full force. The meeting between the two leaders was unprecedented in the message that both sent to the West, in particular the US. They unveiled a global alliance with an anti-US theme. They both condemned certain states' attempts to impose their own democratic standards on other countries. Another issue they addressed covered their bilateral trade and the US dollar. Although this has been addressed by both before, this time was different since the political atmosphere was different. They announced the need to expand their bilateral trade in national currencies due to the predictability of the US dollar. This comes after the U.S. threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars due to U.S. sanctions in the event of an alleged Russian invasion of Ukraine. Militarily, the two countries pledged to cooperate more while strengthening their military alliance. And here's where China displayed its support for Russia against NATO. Both opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. There was an announcement made by the Russian president regarding energy, which also appeared to be a slap in the face of Europe when it came to their dependency on Russian gas. Putin announced a new deal to supply China with 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas from its Far East region, the largest such transit of gas in the world. But when it comes to energy, there is one obvious supplier that Europe can look towards, and that is Iran. If Europe wants to show good faith, especially in the Vienna talks, it can do that by having Iran provided with its energy needs. Iran has the second largest natural gas reserves in the world, holding more than 17% of global discovered gas fields. That does it for this section of the program. We look forward to getting your messages.
The U.S. is dead set to push Russia into a corner. But why? European countries are realizing that may not be in their best interest, like France and Germany, who don't want a war in their own backyard. Even the EU has realized this, which may explain why EU and France have called for a European army to not be subservient to NATO. But the U.S. has literally shot itself in the foot. Russia and China have aligned themselves against the U.S., while European countries may not be so keen to follow in the U.S. lead. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. I've been Omid Roshanda, filling in for Kaveh. Please write to us and let us know how we're doing. But before I say goodbye, a word for the Europeans, in case you forgot. Iran has a lot of gas. Oil, too.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.